Good afternoon and welcome everybody to this executive forum during World Mental Health Day and also Mental Health Week. So welcome and please enjoy the lunch, and we've got some phenomenal speakers and people to talk to us around mental health and both how to look after our mental health but also how to get opportunities to get support and treatment early. Can we start please by, I'd like to start by inviting Dilys up here to say a few words on behalf of the Windsor Group, who's in fact organising the event today. But before Dilys comes up, can I just acknowledge the traditional owners of the land that we meet and pay my respect to elders past, present and emerging. And thank you all for coming. And Dilys, thank you very much for organising, and can we have a couple of words from you? Thank you.
Thank you, Ivan, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to this afternoon. It is my pleasure to invite you here to today's function, and I know that there are a number of you that are very familiar faces to Windsor, but there's also a number of you that may not know who we are. So I'm going to very quickly introduce you to the Windsor Group. We are a for-profit, for-purpose social enterprise, and our core business is actually recruitment, but we offer a variety of HR services, and one of those services is a partnership arrangement that we have with QUT, and we run an engagement survey / satisfaction survey, if you like, for volunteers and employees within organisations. That's just one of the things that we do. The way that we qualify as a social enterprise is by putting on functions like this and building capacity of individuals that work within the non-profit sector. We have entertained almost 1,000 attendees at events like this over the last couple of years, with just under 300 events. So you could be forgiven for thinking that we're an event management company, but no, our core business is recruitment, but that is what we do to qualify as being for a social enterprise. Today is a very special event for us on this very special International Day of Recognition, where we work. I was talking to Ivan about the actual focus of today, so I'm going to leave that to Ivan to talk about. But from our perspective, it's a really special day, and I'm very, very thankful that you're here and Ivan has come back again. Thank you, Ivan, and we have, as Ivan has said, some exceptional speakers for you today in Brett and James and Michael. So thank you so much for agreeing to come, especially today, because I know today is a very, very busy day for all of you. And Ivan said to us before, it's been on the radio 6 times already today. So we're very, very fortunate to have them here. So it gives me great pleasure to formally introduce you to Ivan, because Ivan's going to be our MC today. And Ivan is the Queensland Mental Health Commissioner, and having worked extensively within mental health system in Queensland for more than 20 years now, he brings substantial policy, academic and patient-centred experience to his role. Ivan's focus is on strengthening partnerships and collaboration, and he oversees the delivery and implementation of the state's mental health, alcohol and other drugs program, Shifting Minds. Ivan's a family man with 4 grandchildren, and he has a great love of music and culture, and has a strong belief in the power of the human connection and community. So we are in very safe hands today. Please welcome Ivan back to the lectern. Thank you.
Thank you, Dilys, and thank you for again putting on this fantastic event. One point of correction, 4 children, 2 grandchildren. I just thought I might have had a few others that I wasn't aware of, but that's all right. Thank you very much. All right. Before we start, can I just say, in case of emergency, please follow the Brisbane Club staff out and onto the green grass out there somewhere. All the bathrooms and utilities are out the door there somewhere, from my understanding, straight down the sort of hallway. And look, if you want to ask some questions, we're going to try and do this as best as we can. So as you're thinking of things, just send your question through. Do you want to write this number down? It's 0412-586-749. I'll repeat that. 0412-586-749. And you can just text your question. We'll try and go through them as best as we can. Hopefully we won't get too many, but we will certainly, you know, try and go through as many as we can. Do I need to repeat that again? Yes. Can I repeat that again? Okay. 0412-586-749. Thank you. All right. Now, before I introduce my speakers, as Dilissa said, a phenomenal group of people who are working in mental health in various ways and have a whole range of experience around, you know, how do we support mental health in the workplace. I'd just like to start just to give some context so people understand just how important mental health, particularly in the workplace, is. As Dilissa touched on the government release, which we helped them actually develop a new plan for Queensland called Shifting Minds. And one of the major pillars around the population stuff is around mental health in the workplace. There's a lot in the plan, but in the population area, so not the services and treatment area, but in the population area, we're focusing the light and the efforts in probably three or four areas. They are the early years. How do we get in early? And then, you know, when I'm talking early, I'm talking point of conception to year two, first 1,000 days. Critical, and the evidence is so clear about how do we improve the mental health of our future generations. Secondly, workplace mental health. Thirdly, which we're going to talk about today. Thirdly, it's about older persons' mental health. We have an aging population, and as you know, loneliness is one of the major factors, both for young people. You probably saw recently a Swinburne University study that says that 51% of all of our young people feel lonely and isolated. That figure is much higher amongst our older Australians. It could be anywhere up to 70-80% to feel that, depending which study you look at. So particularly older Australians and their mental health. And then overall in that population space, we're just looking at how do you maintain wellness. Most of us have good mental health, and we've got to think about how do we maintain that. So what do we need to do, like we do around physical health? What do we need to do around keeping mentally healthy? So they're the four sort of big areas that we're focusing on the plan around the population stuff. Now let me take you back to the workplace mental health. It is evident, and PricewaterhouseCoopers, are they in the room here today? I haven't seen anybody. They did a recent study which actually looked at the cost of mental health, and it says that untreated mental health costs the Australian economy annually around $11 billion in the workplace. And that's around people being absent, but people also being present, but reduced productivity, but also workers' comp claims, etc., etc. Cost the Australian economy about $11 billion annually. And just keep in mind, for every dollar that you as an employer invest in mental health, in a broad sense, the return back to the employment environment is estimated to be about $2.30 for every dollar invested. And I think they're the sorts of things that we as employers need to keep in mind, that if we do make an investment, there is more than double return in terms of that investment. Now, you're probably aware that more recently we've had, you know, I can name them, you know, Lady Gaga and a whole range of these other people have come out in terms of singers, athletes, actors, politicians talking about their mental health. And look, that's great. And I think that's important to have some of these people who have some influence in our society to feel comfortable to come out. And this does contribute, I think, overall in society to a decrease in the stigma levels in our society. But can I say, when you look at particularly in the workforce, it's not having that sort of same impact in terms of providing a safe environment for people to talk around mental health in their workforce, in their workplace. I think these are some of the challenges. Some of the recent studies have indicated that approximately 60% of all employees, and that's being pretty conservative, feel that they can't talk about their mental health in their workplace. But 80% plus say that they would like to see their employer and employment environment providing, enabling an opportunity to talk about their mental health and to be supported. So you can see 60% say they can't, but 80% plus say we should be looking at what we can do around mental health. And I'll just finish with a couple of things. I think sometimes, and what happens is, mental health within a whole range of organisations, and you know, being in the public system for a long time, but also recently in the non-government system, it's always left to the HR. And that's only one component. That's only one component. HR should not be the driver of all things to do with mental health in your organization. They're certainly a player. But also things like, say, well, you know, people say, we do really well for mental health. We've got EPA. We provide EPA. That's, again, only one component of a bigger picture. And so I think these are some of the, they're part of the answer, but they're not the total answer. I think people need to keep in mind. But what people do say, and most studies will tell you this, this is what people say, you know, we need a more open and acceptable culture. Now, these things aren't easy to achieve. They're easy to say, but, you know, more open, acceptable culture where, for example, you know, I can talk about mental health. People talk about, and they link some of that stuff around their own confidence ability to deal with, you know, training and support and communication, all of those things as being really critical. But also people talk about, how do I get, you know, clear ideas where I can get help rather than sort of having to hold that myself. And, you know, in the work environment, we can talk about, you know, how do I, it doesn't always have to be top down, can also be at that colleague level, how do I provide support to those individuals? But people clearly say that if we're going to change the culture and address some of these things around open and accepting culture, they need management support. Management needs to be on site. So leadership position, management are critical if we're going to change some of this. And culture, I know, is both established from a bottom up and a top down, but clearly we've got to get management on site. And, you know, organisations that are doing this really well, management is clearly on site. So I think that's a real message. People also talked about there should be no fear about talking around mental health. And fear comes up in most studies about, for example, if I do say something, will that impact on my ability to be promoted? Will that impact on my ability for, you know, job opportunities, for travel, for all sorts of things, people. But so fear comes up pretty regularly around talking about it. And then they talk generally about a more supportive work environment where, for example, you don't always need to, you know, go to your manager, but you might get some of that, you know, collegial type of support from your colleagues, etc. Rather than people who are your colleagues fearing to talk to you about something, for example, because I don't know what to do with that. And if I engage in that discussion, you know, what am I going to do with that? You know, so trying to build a culture where it's okay, you don't have to be, you know, Dr. Brett Emerson, a psychiatrist, before you talk to someone. You can talk to a colleague who's just there to support you. And it's about what you do with that information and how you provide that level of support to that individual. So there are some of the things which are really critical in this space. And I'm hoping that we'll hear from our group of speakers around some of the ways that we can actually address that. So let me just quickly now go and quickly introduce some of these speakers for you. So I'll start with Professor Brett Emerson. Brett is the professor of the School of Clinical Medicine. Brett Emerson is also the chair of the Queensland branch of the Royal Australian New Zealand College of Psychiatry. He's the executive director of mental health at Metro North Hospital Health Services, eminent staff specialist at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. He also chairs the Queensland Mental Health Clinical Collaborative and Centre, and Central Mental Health Clinical Cluster. He's a member of the Queensland Mental Health and Drug and Alcohol Advisory Council for the Mental Health Commission, and sits on the board of directors at the Australian Council of Healthcare Standards and Stepping Stones, which is an NGO. Brett is a member of the Order of Australia for his significant services to medicine, particularly to psychiatry, medical administration, and through contributions to mental health groups across the state. Professor Emerson is an author whose research interests include service evaluation and developing benchmark indicators to improve the physical health of the severely mentally ill. So welcome, Brett, and please come up. Our second panel member is Mr. James Hill, who is a passionate mental health advocate and 2018 Life Suicide Prevention Award finalist and 2019 Queensland Mental Health Commission Individual Mental Health Award finalist. His career began in the electricity industry in 1994 in the UK. A move to Australia in 2006 saw him take on a role in the electricity distribution industry based in southeast Queensland. After his own battle with mental illness, James saw the need for workplaces to adapt and tackle the stigma surrounding mental health challenges. Together with his colleague Aaron McCann, they set about influencing change in Energy Queensland. Backed by the CEO, they developed the role of mental health advocates. Quickly, this unique role involves providing employees internal support with mental health challenges, delivery of the pilot program Mates in Energy, which is tackling suicide rates in the energy industry, and particularly, as we know, the rates of suicide amongst men, particularly. You know, 75% of all suicides in Australia, men primarily between the age of 35 and 45. James and Aaron have worked in the past 2 years and delivered a top three place in the 2018 AHRIA Workplace Mental Health Awards and the 2019 Mental Health Commission Workplace Award finalists. Additionally, James is a mental health first aid instructor studying a Bachelor of Counselling at the University of Sunshine Coast. Outside of work, James is a speaker for Beyond Blue and is developing his own brand of mental health education and wellbeing. So welcome, James. Thank you. And our third panel member is Michael O'Hanlon. Michael's work experience includes over 20 years in various operational management roles in the mining and information technology business units of BHP, followed by a period in a major information technology company and a state-based OH&S regulator. For the past 13 years, Michael has worked at Beyond Blue, an independent not-for-profit organisation working to ensure that all Australians achieve their best mental health. His current role of workplace engagement manager combines his professional roles and personal experience of depression, anxiety, so as to advocate to corporations, industry associations, and peak bodies about the benefits of improving mental health within their workplace. Welcome, Michael. All right, so I've got some questions which I'm going to ask the panel, but I'm also hoping that you'll send some questions through. We can go and grill them some more at the end with some more questions, so that'll be fine. So the first question is, could you please describe an organisational approach to wellbeing at work that you have taken, and do you see it as your responsibility to be leading some of the sort of mental health and wellbeing aspects within your workplace? Who wants to go first? Brett, do you want to go first?
That works. So I work in what's called Metro North HHS, so we are the largest health service in Australia. So we've got about 19,000 employees. We cover the Royal Brisbane, Prince Charles, Redcliffe, Cornwallshire, Kilcoyd, and we look after a population of about 1 million people. We've got about 19,000 employees, and I can certainly say, like, as an HHS, we've been there since about 2009. Certainly in the last 4 or 5 years with changes of leadership, and, you know, the current CEO and the current Chief Operating Officer have brought a big change. And so, as Ivan said earlier, it starts at the top. And I think, you know, our current Chief Executive and Koo have brought a change. Now, our Koo's a former mental health nurse, started back in the day at 10B in Townsville, and there was a scandal there. But she's turned out to be a real advocate for staff well-being, and they even dropped the term mental health. You know, well-being is the term that is used and rolled out. But there is a level of care going into decisions and how to look after staff that we haven't seen before, which is good. Previously, it was very much an HR process, and HR was by the book. You know, there's a list of policies, and you follow this. But care has gone into that now, and as I say, I think we are seeing a much better workforce. And as Ivan has said, you'll have a more productive workforce, you'll have a better workforce who probably wants to come to work, but they will also want to stay with you. And so I think, you know, those are very important factors. The other thing, I might just sort of turn this around a little bit. I've been on the board of a place called Stepping Stone, you'll have seen, for 25 years. And Stepping Stone, it works on what's called the clubhouse model, but it's designed to get people with mental illness work. And even though we're here talking about the existing population of employees, I'd just like to put a plug in that for people with mental illness, one of the best things you can do for them, other than giving them an income, a roof over their head, and you know, mental health support and treatment, is giving them a job. You know, a job is just so important for people to you know, get into a routine, get off disability, have a reason to get up in the morning. So even though we're talking about, you know, caring for our existing employees, please give some thought to those people who don't have work and would benefit greatly from work. Just to put a plug in for Stepping Stone, they actually have this thing called transitional employment, and I don't know whether any of your organisations might be interested in this, but essentially, where I work in Metro North, we're one of their biggest employers, so we've got about 5 positions, and a person with a mental illness comes in every 6 months and does that job. One of the beauties of Stepping Stone is people fear that if you take someone on with mental health issues, they won't be there. The guarantee Stepping Stone gives is if that person's unwell and can't come to work, someone else will. So the jobs are covered. So where we work, they do our they clean offices where Ivan used to work. So we've got an eating disorder place out at Indooroopilly. They do all that cleaning, gardening, our community care unit at Royal Brisbane. They do, again, gardening, cleaning, you know, general support for people. So it is a good plug. So if you're interested in, or if you've got tasks that are, you know, relatively routine in terms of gardening, cleaning, administrative type work, give Stepping Stone a call, because they'd love it, and people do benefit from employment. So that's it from me.
Look, I think
I want to plug in.
Yeah, you can keep that. I mean, I think that is that. But again, it goes back into that whole stuff. How do we as an organisation feel comfortable to employ people who may have, and you know, Stepping Stone supports people who have a severe and complex mental illness. And I have to say, I've employed people who've got schizophrenia and who, you know, who are battling bipolar, phenomenal employees. So it's about the culture that we create. And also, I think Brett's point is around employment opportunities.
The other thing is, after those 6 months, they've usually got confidence, they've usually then got people who can be referees. So the chances of getting future employment is very, very good. And as I say, we've had several people go on to permanent jobs within rural Brisbane. And so, you know, if you do have jobs that you could give to people with that, not only will you benefit, but the individual benefits. And as I say, having people who have a known mental illness in the workforce does, you know, reduce stigma, and it increases awareness of, you know, mental health.
Great. James, in your context, can you tell us what your approach has been, particularly in your industry, around well-being at work? And do you see this as your responsibility, or your organisation's responsibility?
As far as responsibility goes, it's a society's responsibility. We've all got a part to play in this. But first, to give a bit of context around what I do, mental health advocate for the business, that hasn't always been what I've done. I've been a tradesperson since the age of 15. Now, I knew nothing about mental illness, absolutely zero, because it didn't affect people like me, or so I thought. I've lived with mental illness my whole life, and now I understand it looking back. But it wasn't until it came to a point where it almost took my life and I needed time off work, and I felt more comfortable lying to work and saying that I had some physical thing wrong with me. So a doctor's note will say James is unfit for work from period A to period B. I felt more comfortable going into work and saying I've got something wrong with my kidneys, I need some time off work, than I did to say that I had clinical depression, bipolar disorder. So I was more comfortable making something up. Now, when I returned to work, the doctor said, you know, after a significant period of recovery time, I got to a point where I wanted to get back to the workplace. And as we've just heard, that's good. That's what you need to do to give your life some fulfillment. But I turned up on the Monday morning, and then I just had a whole list of emails, because I was running a depot on the Sunshine Coast. list of emails, list of problems, list of stuff to do. By the Thursday, I was in a bad spot. So my doctor said, well, let me have a look at your return to work plan and see if there's anything missing. I haven't got one. And he said, well, you're off work then until I can see that. And I said, well, I don't want to be off work. So I came into work and said, well, my doctor wants to see my return to work plan. They said, well, what do you want in it? I said, well, I don't know, because I've never seen one. The message I sort of subtly got was, well, if you can't do your job, maybe we'll find someone else who can, which pretty much lit a fire under my backside to go, this isn't good enough. So that's how my role came to be. So for a number of years, I was battling for somebody in the business to listen to me, that we needed to look at the way we deal with mental health and mental illness in the workplace differently. And it wasn't until we had that backing of the senior leadership, as we've just spoken about, where the CEO believed in what I was saying, listened to what I had to say, created a role for me to go into the business and do things differently. So just handing out an EAP card and saying, ring this number if you're struggling, is not good enough. We need to build in stuff. We can't just go leaders and they should know how to deal with staff. Well, no. We need to upskill people to help that. By me sharing my journey and the condition that I live with, that opens the door for other people to have those conversations and have that support and those mechanisms in place. But as far as responsibility, we've all got a part to play in this, and just having those conversations can open that door.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Michael, Beyond Blue, probably one of the sort of most well-recognized mental health brands in this country. How are you managing well-being both within the organization, but also how are you working with organizations such as many that are in this room and others, particularly in the private sector, etc., in terms of how do they look after the well-being of their employees?
Yes, briefly, Beyond Blue does have its own mental health strategy, which is part of our business plan. It's integrated into what we do. We're not perfect. The first run through that was probably too detailed and didn't connect with the staff. Second run through it makes a lot more sense. And we practice what we preach in a broad sense of the word. If we didn't, then I shouldn't be here. But my privilege is I get to see a lot of workplaces across Australia and what they're doing. And my reflection, if I look back over the last 10 odd years, is the shift that's happened in workplaces is from, we've got this problem called mental health, which is an issue in itself, because mental health is not a problem. We all have mental health. It's mental health conditions we're really talking about. We've got this problem. How do we get rid of these people? How do I filter them out? How do I not employ them in the first place? To an understanding gradually with education and raising awareness how, well, wait a minute, almost 50% of the Australian population will experience a mental health condition at some time in life. So what are you doing? Ruling out half the population to recruit from? One in five of your employees will experience a mental health condition, roughly. So, and you can't predict it. I could pass any test you want to give me today, and in a month's time, something may happen in my life that will push me down the pathway towards a mental health condition. So the understanding from a problem to really an opportunity, as Ivan has pointed out, for all the reasons, if you want an economic leader, return on investment, if you want a HR leader, staff retention, employer of choice, all of this kind of information has become more widely known, and that's created a shift around this topic where a mentally healthy workplace doesn't just focus on the one in five who may be experiencing a mental health condition. It actually focuses on everybody in the workplace. How do we keep the healthy healthy? What are the proactive things we can do in our organisation? What are the organisational structures and support we can put in place for that? What are the protective factors we need to look at for people who may be under some stress? How do we identify our psychological risk factors in the workplace, as we need to be doing under our H&S audits? And what are the supports we have for people that may have a mental health condition? So it's become an initiative for everybody in the workplace. And Ivan's mentioned the bottom-up and top-down approach. And that's where you see the biggest impact in workplaces, where I can think of companies large global companies based in Australia where the board has asked the executive team, what are we doing about this? What are you doing about this? How are you doing it? So it's driving from the very top down, and it's being incorporated into existing practices like public health and safety. The second letter, H, is about health. You can't talk about health and not talk about mental health. So it empowers public health and safety. It empowers risk management in terms of staff retention, losing good staff if you don't have a mentally healthy workplace, and it empowers well-being. And as Brett has said, it's much more now a conversation, a holistic conversation around well-being. And even if you look back at the Beyond Blue website, we've now got sections on that website that talk about personal best. How do you maintain your personal best? Yes, we've still got the information about supporting people who may be experiencing mental health conditions. We've got our forums and our support lines. That's all still there. But moving up the spectrum, what are the preventative things we can do? What are the proactive things we can do to stay healthy? So that's the kind of change I've seen over time.
That's good to hear. Good to hear that things are moving in the right direction. Building on that, and I won't go from one to the other, we're sort of with this question, happy for people to respond as they see fit, but could you share some examples with us, whether you've seen other industries or with your own industries, of initiatives and examples that have assisted in sort of driving a positive mental health and well-being culture?
Thanks, Trent.
I got the mic.
Yes, what we've started to see is industry sectors looking at this more holistically, and I think of ones you might not initially come to mind. So it started with the mining industry, the construction industry kicked it up, the Energy Networks Australia, Water Services Association of Australia, Consultant Australia, a group of consulting engineers, geotechnical engineers. They have recognised as peak bodies that to make a change in culture, which is what we're really wanting to make happen here, you need an industry-wide approach, a framework. So, for instance, the construction industry had a mental health roundtable 2 years ago, looking at what are the challenges, where do they want to be, where are they now, how are they going to get there. Evolved out of that was a blueprint for mental health and wellbeing in the construction industry, which is now being engaged at different levels, from both the large employers down to the small employers. So that's where you really start to see some great examples. Now, when I said they're not the industries you might first think of, what is the demographic of those industries? It's the male-dominated industries, and typical, probably around middle age. Now, I've pointed out before, that's exactly the demographic that has the highest prevalence rates of depression and anxiety, and the highest prevalent rates of suicide. If those industries can get together and drive culture change like this, then my challenge would be, why don't accountants, lawyers, any other professions do the same thing? And the irony in our experience is, if we go down to a construction site and go down to the crib huts where the guys are and engage with them, they listen and they respond. They acknowledge the challenge once you give them the opportunity. Conversely, often engaging in, say, the CBD of Brisbane, it's a much quieter audience. The stigma is actually higher in some ways. So that's where I've seen the big change, is where sectors have seen this as an initiative, sometimes responding to challenges like fly in, fly out workforces and the parliamentary inquiries that have come from those, but taking it to the much broader approach across the whole of their business.
Brett, is there anything about, particularly for example, like, you know, picking up some of the other sort of groups, particularly, you know, lawyers and accountants, but also medical professionals? Oh, yes. We know that the rates of particularly mental illness, but also suicide, is pretty high. Is there something that the College of Psychiatry or the, you know, the AMA, etc., are doing in this space?
Certainly one of the things that the AMA, College of Psychiatrists, and all the medical colleges are looking at the moment is there is a misapprehension or misinformation. So most doctors are under the belief that if they go to see a psychiatrist or a GP about their mental health, that they will be automatically reported to APRA and the medical board, so therefore they don't go, or they wait, leave it too late. That's actually wrong information. You will only ever be reported to APRA if the doctor you're seeing really believes you are at risk of, you know, hurting patients or, you know, you're going to work drunk, that, those sort of things. So there's an active program underway to sort of retell the story that, you know, you are quite safe as a medical practitioner or any health practitioner to go and see somebody. The reporting is only mandatory if, you know, if you believe that, you know, say you've got a surgeon who, you know, is manic and, you know, you don't really want him in theatre. In those circumstances, you have to get involved. But certainly I think there's growing awareness that, you know, people shouldn't hold back and get in early. So that's certainly something. And equally, there are certain groups within the medical profession that are at greater risk of, say, suicide. Mm. And some of that has to do with access. So anaesthetists have access to really good products if you want to put yourself to sleep. So they're one of the groups that really, you know, the College of Anaesthetists looks much more, you know, at looking at the well-being of their staff. And certainly, you know, one of the things I do, you know, Metro North, as you know, has 19,000 employees. But I would get a call as the Executive Director of Mental Health. I'd be called at least twice a week by somebody in that organisation about a member of their staff on what they should do. So, as I say, one of the advantages of being a psychiatrist in that group is people know me, they can get to me. And as I say, I would at least twice a week be organising a referral or an admission or you know, talking to people to get them into treatment. So, you know, having someone like me around it is handy. Look, the other thing I would... Have people here heard about... what's it called? Mental Health First Aid?
Yeah, Mental Health First Aid.
If you haven't had some of your staff through Mental Health First Aid, that's a great program for, you know, for raising awareness and also helping people how to deal with, you know, if you are approached, what to say, how to recognise it. We're about to go into accreditation, and so there's lists of mandatory training. So I did the domestic violence prevention training this week, and I was sort of sitting there thinking, you know, because it trains you on how to talk to colleagues and stuff like that. It's really very... If people put into place how to deal with, you know, domestic and family violence, it really is, you know, it's about mental health and well-being as
that's
well.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, if you get those programs and maybe sort of broaden them a little bit, they're great programs. And as I say, I was through it in about 20 minutes and actually learned something. Yeah, so, yeah.
Very good. So, I mean, it's great to hear that we've got things happening and clearly there is, you know, much greater saturation and also take-up. But how do we measure and monitor the effectiveness of these things? For example, if I take the training or even the apps, there's lots of training available. There's lots of apps. There's thousands of apps going, have I got an app for you? You know, it's every day we get, you know, what are some of the things? How do we measure the effectiveness of what we're doing in the workplace? And also, how do we measure how it's impacting on employees, but also the business?
Well, doesn't the Queensland Government, you could talk about, have a target that we've got to improve happiness?
Yes, that's
right. In the Queensland community?
That's right.
I'm not sure how they're going to measure. Can you say something about that happiness
there
measure?
There is a measure of happiness.
There is a measure of happiness.
That's
look
right.
At Ivan.
That's why I'm happy.
But do you want to just say something about, as a state, for the first time, they're looking at trying to measure happiness as one of the 28 indicators of mental health. So not only are we, you know, do we look at suicide rates,
correct.
But we're looking at community happiness.
We are, and really, I mean, there is various, you know, I suppose, standardised tools that we can use to measure it. But you know, some countries, for example, just taking this debate a little bit further was, you know, like if you look at New Zealand, Scotland, Iceland, for example, we currently focus on our societal happiness around if our GDP is growing. And I think that's not really making lots of people happy just because our GDP is not falling or not growing. People are talking about, and you've heard the New Zealand Prime Minister, but also, if you get a chance, listen to the Scottish Prime Minister, what about a well-being budget? How would it look differently if we measured not how the GDP is going, but we measured things like happiness and the well-being of our society, and then we used those resources. And when do we land that whole argument that we are all going to be happy and better off just because our GDP is rising? And how do we say, well, yes, that's an important measure in many ways, right, employment and growth, but how do we measure and start to invest that back into the happiness, the well-being of our society? And that's a real debate happening now, both nationally but also internationally. And some countries have said, we're actually not going to be that worried and report and measure all the time around GDP, but we will start to measure, for example, the well-being of our society and using things like the happiness measure. There's some of the shifts which are happening, and I think that also applies to our workplace. You know, yes, we might, yes, productivity and, you know, output, all those things are important, but unless you start to actually also look at the well-being of your staff, that will definitely suffer. And just because you're focusing, and you have to as a business, there's no doubt there's all those things, but the reality is, unless you also start to say, we're also going to invest some of that back into the people that are, you know, that are producing this, it's not going to be a great work environment when it comes to mental health.
There was a headline in the Times of London the other day that said Scotland is a very unhappy place and you should move. I forget what country it was. It was Lapland or Estonia or something like that. It was the headline, you know, leave Scotland and move to wherever if you want to be happy.
As an Englishman, I'll...
You'll support that.
just with the measurement stuff, I can talk from my organisation's point of view. Look, there's many ways we can measure stuff, surveys, satisfaction things, productivity. But for me, the best way is more qualitative. Out on the ground, having conversations. And what I've seen in the last 2 years since I've been in this role is that conversations are happening that are involving our health and well-being. So before, you know, we work in a high-risk environment, you know, fixing power poles and electricity every day. We used to roll up on site, you know, back in the day, and we go, Rob, what are we doing today? We're changing this pole. What's going to hurt us today? And we go through whatever, and we get into it. Now that conversation's different. Now we talk about, well, how am I today? Am I fit for the job? And we don't necessarily need to even go into talking about anything. We can use colours, numbers, whatever it may be, a scale. We don't need to say whether it's physical or mental, but today I'm all right to be at work, but I might not be all right to be at the top of that pole or doing something high risk. But these conversations are happening now. The teams are sort of building in, okay, well, what do we need to do to support you today? Okay, well, maybe I'll just stay on the ground, or maybe I'll just do this today. That's cool. If they want to elaborate more, great. We're trying to build that culture. But for me, that's the best way of measuring it, is being out on the ground and seeing what conversations are happening.
And changing those conversations and measuring some of the qualitative stuff rather than GDP and numbers and absentee days and all that stuff.
Yeah. Measurements are a key challenge in this whole space, and depending on if your organisation's an engineering organisation and you want all these 10.963, whatever, some precise number, versus the qualitative measures that Ivan's talking about. Broadly, there are tools available. So the Office of Industrial Relations here has an assessment tool called People at Work that's available to, you can run over your workplace, gives you a score, and you can run that over different times and get different results to see how things are changing. Or you can go down to the very simple things like, if you do staff engagement surveys, pop in the simple question, do you think Windsor Group is a mentally healthy workplace? And you measure how many people say yes or no. Would you be comfortable talking to your manager to disclose that you may be experiencing a mental health condition? Yes, no, on a scale. Would you be comfortable working with someone next to you if they disclosed they were experiencing a mental health condition? Yes, no. Measures, indirect measures of stigma, indirect measures of people's sense of, is this a mentally healthy workplace, indirect measures of the level of awareness and training that managers may have had in the workplace. So you can do some very simple things, and there are some tools out there. They're progressing down the classic pathway of being developed by academics and then being translated into a tool that, rather than being a 10-page questionnaire, becomes a double-sided page. So that's the process that's happening.
you've all touched on training and a whole range of things. And look, and I think, you know, a lot of organisations will tell you they get bombarded with approaches, as I said, with apps and training. Have we got the answer for you? What's been some of your experiences around training and what's worked, particularly when it comes to your leadership, but also your staff, but also leadership in terms of, you know, building a mentally healthy culture in the organisation?
Where I've seen it work really well at a leadership level is that it's incorporated into the existing leadership development program. It's just part of the normal work in the organisation. It's not this standalone thing you're going to do about mental health. And I've seen organisations do that where, even a little bit more indirect, where in a case study where they may be looking at leadership and different examples, one of them will be a case study that relates to mental health. So that's a way of embedding it into the DNA of the business. Why not build it into your induction training? You do enough induction training about physical safety, which is the same about psychological safety. Yes, I would suggest if someone came to you and said, my training will solve all your problems, I don't think I'd recommend them necessarily, because we're talking about a cultural shift of which training is an element of the pie. Yes, you need to increase awareness, you need to increase understanding, no doubt about that. But unless you change the culture, unless you have leadership by example, unless you have the processes in place, unless you have stay at work rather than return to work policies in place, you're not hitting the whole ecosystem around changing a culture. So definitely training is an element, and it's best when it's integrated as part of the normal training curriculum of an organisation, where I've seen it work well.
James, Brett?
Well, as far as training goes, I'll just touch on what we've been doing at Energy Queensland. So we partnered up with Mates in Construction and developed Mates in Energy, which is a suicide prevention program. And we've got 7,500 employees across the state. So for the last 2 years, we've been rolling that pilot out through the organisation. Mates have only got one full-time energy employee, so it's been between myself, my colleague, and the Mates employee rolling this out. But the general awareness is just a one-hour session, and our business is committed to that, which I think is fantastic to be able to afford a one-hour session for, you know, 7,500 people. It's a big commitment. But so far, we've had 6,600 people go through just a one-hour general awareness, and for some of them, that's the first time they've ever had a conversation about mental health in the workplace. Particularly, you know, the guys out in the field, always one of them, we just don't talk about that stuff. And we've given them the opportunity to have some skills and some tools just to have that conversation for an hour. We don't need to drag people away for 3 weeks worth of training and hammer them. It's just giving you some broad, and it's worked really well because we've seen a shift in some of that stuff that, you know, we do have to have surveys and stuff just to monitor that. You know, I like it and I don't. You know, it's good to give you a guide, but it's not always telling the full story. But we've seen a shift just in the fact that people now are open enough to recognize when they or someone close to them may be struggling. And that's just the start of it, because that opens the conversation, and conversations can change lives and save lives. So, yeah.
They have this orientation program for new staff across Metro North, and I get rolled out two or three times a year. It's my turn. And I don't declare when I start that I'm a psychiatrist. So I usually start with, and at the Royal Brisbane, the first question is, how many were born at Royal Brisbane? And, you know, probably two-thirds of the audience put their hand up. I then say, how many of you have actually seen a psychiatrist? And one person might put their hand up. I then do my presentation at the end of it. I say, well, none of you can now say you haven't seen a psychiatrist. And how many have you? And the hands reluctantly go up. But it's just a good way of starting to raise the issue of, you know, the stigma of, you know, psychiatry and presentation. So I think the more, you know, people get out and talk about it, the better.
You keep going.
And put a bit of humour in there too.
Bit of humour in there. Humour is important. Just to add to that, only recently, like last week, I was invited by the DG of Main Roads and Transport, which is interesting. And just to put out a very casual discussion chat before Mental Health Week, to all of his staff in a DG message about the importance of mental health and the culture that he wants to build in the organisation. It's okay to talk, and he talked about some of his own stuff and challenges of running big organisations, etc. You know, he gave that latitude. And one of the things that I've heard, and I just wanted to pass by the panel, why it's important from the top, because it keeps that authorising environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sort of takes away some of that fear. If someone like the DG who runs this organisation gives the authorising around, the management and other people fall into place. You know what I mean? That's the sort of stuff that people talked about in main roads and transport. And he gives them the authorising environment to create, you know, that environment, you know, at the local level about how to look after each other's mental health. As James said, today I'm not ready to go on that pole. That's okay, I'll go today. And it's
you've been a pole dancer for years.
I've been a pole dancer for years. You should have told them that.
Oh, sorry. I'm his agent, so Friday and Saturday night.
But it's that sort of stuff that's really critical. But
cheaper
to have
available.
Yeah, that's right. Cheaper rates.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, to have the DG, you know, self-disclose, but also generally about, you know, the stresses of work, even at his levels, etc., and how you need to look after that, gives that authorising environment for that organisation, which I thought was phenomenal. And we just had a very casual chat. His deputy DG sort of interviewed us, and she made some comments, and it was just giving the 9,500 staff out there who actually get the message, etc., really that authorising environment to say, it's okay. It's okay. We want to help you. We want to support you. You're valued. And mental health is like any other illness. We've got to manage it within the workplace as well.
Yeah, I think that large organisation I was talking about earlier, the shift that occurred in that organisation, and I asked one of the senior people there, what would you say had changed in the organisation? And it goes to the heart of what I was just saying. Three words. Permission to talk.
Mm.
That's what had changed. Mm. And that comes from the top, and that is changing culture. Mm. And culture is set both at the top and by actions across the organisation. So I totally agree with the power and the importance of that example from Main Roads. It's really great.
And I'm hoping that other organisations and CEOs, whether public or individual, will do similar things, because I think it does keep that alignment.
Yeah,
just obviously both sides of it. So I was beating pretty hard on the door to try and influence some change. I wasn't getting anywhere. And then when we had new CEO, new executive leadership team, they actually listened to me.
Mm.
And they backed me. And for a CEO to create a position that doesn't really exist anywhere else, entrust it into me and say, go do what you need to do, whatever you think, I think it's a brave move, but it sets the tone.
It sets the tone.
From the top down.
I wasn't looking up Ivan's booking availability. I was actually trying to find our CEO's message. But what's interesting, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, Mental Health Week wouldn't have even been acknowledged.
No.
This week, the whole, you know, CE's letter to the staff was about, it's Mental Health Week, it's, you know, it's important to look after your own mental health and well-being, and then went on to describe some of the things the organisation's doing. So just the fact that it's now out there, and as I say, 19,000 employers, they don't delete them, you know, they're at least aware that, you know,
correct,
it's coming from the chief executive,
yes,
that, you know, this is important, and that they, you know, from the top down, the expectation is you will be looked after.
And I think, I mean, just to sort of round off this back to where I started, organisations, boards, chief, are seeing the value of this. There is a cost benefit here if you do this well. You know, like in the public system or in the private system, to recruit good people is expensive, you know, and it's a process you've got to go, but you also have lots of skills just walking out the door, or etc. People are recognizing that, you know, once you recruit good people, you want to hold on to them, and they may have some of their own life challenges throughout this, but fundamentally they've got the skill set, the knowledge, the experience to help you as an organisation to move. I think there's much more, I'm seeing much more of that now than I ever did before. It was more around, we'll just recruit someone else, they're not ready, there's no return to work, they won't be able to do this job again. It's a very different discussion now, and I have to say, I've certainly noticed in the last 10 years a very different discussion around this. Final question before I think dessert will be served, so I'm going to ask them one more question. If you keep texting your question through, if there was some, you know, a summary of your learnings and some tips that you could give to this audience and other people about what's worked and improved the mental health and the mental health culture within your organisation. Just some tips.
Conversations. I mean, we need to talk about it. Without conversations without being able to talk about this stuff, you can put whatever you like in place, none of it's going to work. Because if we're not open enough to talk about stuff, nothing's going to work. So for me, just opening those conversations, and even if you, Beyond Blue, look, they mean a lot to me. I owe my life to that organisation. So, but you go on their website and there's that much free stuff. It doesn't need to cost a fortune. Like, I'm a speaker for them. So if your organisation wants somebody to come in and have a conversation, you can request a speaker and they'll send somebody for free.
I'm his manager.
It's better than pole dancing anyway.
To me, those conversations, but it doesn't have to cost anything, and there's resources available to facilitate some of that stuff as well. So other organisations, but Beyond Blue holds a place in my heart. So.
And again, particularly for smaller organisations, I think that's a really good point, because people think this is going to be massively expensive, costly. There's a lot of stuff out there that you can do, and it is around the cultural stuff, so it doesn't have to cost you a great deal. So I think just keep that in mind.
Our Indigenous metalheads start to talk a bit about the importance of yarning, I think it's called. And this is an extension that could come out of the Indigenous community, because I think that's probably the best thing that we can do.
Of course.
Have conversations, as you said.
I'm going to talk to two sides of this. One, for the medium to large organisations, where the tip is that this is not just an initiative. This is not a tick-the-box exercise. This is fundamentally shifting the DNA of your organisation and locking it in. That's the only way you'll make the change. I'm kind of old enough and grey enough to remember when I worked for BHP, OH&S was really important out on the sites, and then they decided, no, it's going to be important in head office. I thought, maybe I'd do a cut my finger and a bit of paper or something. But it was shifting the culture of the whole organisation by making that important and part of everything that happened across the business. It's exactly the same kind of change we're looking at with mental health. So my vision is kind of, we get to the point where a business will look at any initiative in the organisation, and yes, you can look at what's the financial impact, but you also look at what's the wellbeing impact, and you balance those two, and wellbeing is physical and mental health. So the success in the big organisations is where it's embedded as part of their ongoing business plan, it's reported against, it's funded, it's resourced. And you can do that through embedding it in existing health and safety, in existing risk management plans and existing wellbeing plans. You don't have to create a whole new department on the side. This empowers many, many other things. The other side of the discussion is small business, which employs most people in Australia. So if we don't talk to them, we're missing most of the employees in the workplace. And the challenge of small business, as we found, because we put up a website and had small business stuff on it, and the challenge was, once we went out to small business and said, well, what else would you like to see? They said, well, we don't actually want to talk to you. Well, what do you mean you don't want to talk to Beyond Blue? Well, it's not that we don't want to talk to Beyond Blue, it's we're time poor. We don't have the time to go to all these different channels to get information. We want to work through our existing trusted advisors. So they want to work through their accountants or their lawyers or their industry association, who give them information that is very relevant to them and spoken and scaled in a way that is relevant to them. Small businesses have many unique challenges. If I'm the small business owner, I've got my house mortgaged against the business. It really impacts my life in a way most people who are employed, it doesn't impact. I know my staff. If I've got a staff of five, I'll know them all personally. And if I get to a point where I've got to downscale my business, I know what impact that's going to have on James's life, because I know he's married with two kids and, oh God, I'm going to sack him. So it's a really stressful place for small businesses. So one of the things we've done is work with advisories or supporters of small business, and we're in the middle of a campaign at the moment with a supporting small business owners to improve their mental health and well-being at work, which is a guide for contacts, friends and families. And to download a PDF that's available on our website. So that's very specific to small business. And small business can do some very simple little things. They don't need a strategy. They don't need a framework. It's the little things they can do every day in their workplace. In some ways, they can do it better. Because, okay, Beyond Blue's now pushing just over 200 people. When I started, it was probably 18 people. And I knew everybody. I don't know half the people at Beyond Blue anymore. We're on two floors, which makes it even more challenging. But in a small business of five people, you know people better, you can see their changes in behaviour, so it's understanding what to do and how to support them at a particular time. So that'd be my tips for both large and small business.
Thank you very much. And look, we're just about here for dessert to be served, so I don't want to stand between you and the dessert. So can we just thank the panel for now, and we can all have some dessert. We'll take 5 minutes or so, 5 minutes, 10 minute break, and then we'll come back with your questions and we can have a bit more of an interactive discussion. Thank you.